This week's episode is all about the world's worst epidemic, so we're going to ask you to do something appropriate to that and help us go viral. Head on to Facebook or Twitter or whichever social media network makes you feel less anxious about the fact that we're now entering the end times. Hunt down our profile, either Worst Foot Forward on Facebook or at Worst Foot on Twitter, and give our posts about this week's show a little like, a little share, and a massive hefty retweet. Best of all, tag in a friend who you think would like it. Don't know about you, but I know who my friends who are into podcasts are. I know who my friends who are history and trivia nerds. And I know my other friends will go, a pod what now? I'm off to listen to BBC Radio 2 in the afternoon. Don't worry about those guys. We're after your podcast-loving heroes. So do that and help this podcast become the oral equivalent of smallpox, Spanish flu, or whatever horrible disease it is that leaves Cillian Murphy stuttering around London in 28 days later on his own. Consider yourself our patient zero. Now go. Spread our very silly, trivial, kind of funny disease. And with that, on with the show.
And welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry Maxtay, and each week I, my co-host, and our guest propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. And this week we aren't quite feeling ourselves. I'm breaking out in cold sweats and hot sweats. I'm trying to sweat both out in even amounts to get a sweat of just the right temperature, actually. I've got a tickly cough, my own fault, really. I swallowed a feather duster last night. I'm suffering from hives. Literally thousands of bees are returning to make honey inside me. My skin has a large rash spreading all over it like a six-year-old has gone wild with acrylics, making me his next art project. And my head is spinning faster than Regan from The Exorcist riding a centrifuge on a merry-go-round. Oh, and I'm balancing incontinence and diarrhea with all the success of a man juggling both bricks and soup. And with me is my own patient zero, the typhoid to my Mary, the dengue to my fever, the whooping to my cough, and the measles to my mumps and rubella. It's Ben Vandervelde.
Hello, everyone. just to let you know that we are proof that you should have vaccinations. And that guy saying that MMR was bad was wrong.
Andrew Wakefield.
Andrew Wakefield, patron saint of this podcast. although I'd put it more as a failure rather than a heroic failure.
But the good patron saint, actually, because his relics would not work.
Yeah,
just the way he'd like them to be.
Yeah, I feel like they'd be homeopathic relics. You sort of like stroke a tiny little bit of one finger and then that's what makes you better.
Yeah, this is a good one.
Yeah, this is going to be a really good
one. It's going to be grim and hopefully uplifting.
Yeah, well, I was talking to our guest just beforehand and saying how this reminds me of our Capital Punishment podcast. Because we're going to have some good history but some sad facts.
Yeah, so, trigger warning, if you're not into like illnesses and mention of blood and pus and boils and things, this mightn't be the episode for you.
Yeah, however, if you are into that, we're going to send the authorities around to your house because you're a troubling individual.
Come to the right place.
Yeah, let's meet our guest. This week's guest is a popular historian, writer, commentator and broadcaster who has worked for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation and has also written as a columnist for the Times Literary Supplement. Born in Australia but settled in the United Kingdom, you may well know him from his joyously extensive Twitter feed showing creepy objects, saints of the day, unusual burial and battle sites, and the untold tales of history. When he's not being the Antipodean answer to Simon Sharma, he is also well known for his brilliant takedowns of the cellar-dwelling, pasty-faced, alt-right effluent sacks that have poisoned the entire platform with calmness, rationality, and humour. Sorry, our guest has got the calmness, rationality, and humour, not the alt-right shit
bags. There's a comma missing somewhere.
Yeah, there absolutely
is.
It's
the opposite of a Simon Sharma, Simon Schumer. Sorry, that's stupid.
That's really stupid. He is the wonderfully erudite Mike Stukesberry.
Thank you. That's the one of the nicest things anybody's ever said about.
Oh, you're
quite hard
welcome
to get it all in 240 characters or 280 characters. It's nice to be able to say it in person.
Thank you. It's a joy to be here.
Which bit of Australia are you from?
I'm from Melbourne.
Oh, cool. And you've swapped that for Sonny Luton.
Yes. Weather's the same. Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah.
Melbourne's lovely.
Yeah.
What's your job?
For various
Do you have a job?
I do. Well, the outright shitbags will tell you that I don't have a job.
Yes.
I do have a job. I just don't tell people what I do. Oh. Let me just say it's in the advertising space.
That's fair. That's
yes.
cool.
So I used to be a teacher for about 15, 16 years, and then I got over here, and the education system
Everything's fine.
Burning trash fires. So I left as soon as I could and moved into the advertising space, and I also do a little bit of sort of history consulting work in terms of...
So history's your passion rather
than... Yeah, history's my passion, but advertising just pays the bills.
Yeah.
Nice. I sort of feel like we could absolutely improve the teaching of history in this country just by sacking all history teachers and sticking your Twitter feed in the classrooms.
Well, that's funny because sometimes I get people who say, my kids love what you tweet. And I'm like, what the hell are you doing letting your kid read my Twitter feed? I wouldn't let my own kid read my Twitter feed. When I have kids, I will probably delete my Twitter feed or change what I do. But that's something that's quite disturbing. I mean, the thing I like about being on Twitter and communicating history is the fact that, one, there's a huge audience for it.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't believe how many people are into it. And two, you can sort of really go down some weird avenues.
Yeah. There's no real easy way. It's like picking your favorite kid, but do you have a favorite historical figure that people mightn't necessarily heard, or a favorite fact about it, one that people would have heard of?
Well, my particular interest, my passion, I'm hoping to go back and do my doctorate in this one day, is 15th and 16th century German history.
Oh, lovely.
And there's a figure, he's not hugely important. He's not, he didn't change the world, but he was part of the events of the time. He was a guy called Goetz von Berlichingen, and he was a knight who lived in what's called Württemberg today, down near Stuttgart, and he basically grew up as a mercenary, and he's like the living embodiment of a heavy metal album cover. I can't remember who he was fighting for, but he was in the middle of a siege at one point, and a cannonball hit his sword. He's holding a sword, and that caused him to cut off his own hand. And so his hand's on the floor.
Please tell me that hand picked up the cannonball and threw it back.
Sorry. So it was his right hand. So it sort of bent back and sort of cut. So his hand's the hand's holding the sword on the ground, right?
Wow.
So they just thought, okay, this doesn't have to mean the end of my mercenary career.
Yeah.
So he goes home and he has someone in the area, I think a local blacksmith, make him an iron hand. So
cool.
He's got this like
Luke Skywalker.
No, yeah, well, like
or Jamie Lannister.
The guy, I sort of liken him to Iron Man because he's got the Mark One, which is really shitty. Can I swear on this?
Oh yeah, so please.
Okay,
do.
the shitty Mark One, which he has to sort of fold into place so he can like hold his, you know, and fight with his sword, but eventually he gets one which I don't know how it works, but it's got something to do with the tendons and the pressure that it exerts on things. But the second one can actually grip.
So he can actually use it.
Yeah. Yeah, he can actually use it. So he then spends the next like 65, 70 years. He'd live to a really ripe old age, and he shouldn't, because the Holy Roman Emperor kept on saying, you got to stay in your castle. You can't come out. You cannot come out.
Go to your castle.
He'd be like, no. He was a right bastard. At one stage, he sided with the peasants in a revolt.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think he got paid more money. So he flipped over. I can't stay mad at him, though.
See, the era of the condottieri, the sort of the mercenaries of higher rank,
absolutely.
More than
Italy
and
but
stuff
he
like
was that, yeah. He was also the sort of feudal lord, so he really reveled in that, and he had a number of castles, and he's famous in Germany. He's like you ask people in Germany about him, and they'll say, "Yeah, Goetz. He's from the Goethe play
because
Goethe wrote a play about
him." Oh, wow, cool!
And the big scene in that play, he's in his castle and he's surrounded and the army's there and they're saying, you know, give up, you are surrounded, there's no chance, there's no way you're going to get out of this. And he basically sort of leans out of the tower and says, you know, you can lick my ass.
like the French knights in Monty Python.
Yeah. Basically, this is the sort of the predecessor of that.
Yeah. He's not going to say lick my hand because it'll go rusty.
He yells, lick me come arsh. Yeah. And you can buy that on little plates and little trinkets and stuff all around the area.
I might be misremembering a fact now. I have a vague idea that there's a Mozart thing where he... It's also a piece that he composed. That is that, or?
Well, that's just because Mozart was a kinky dude. Right?
Yes, yeah.
He was into that kind of thing.
But, maybe he was into this guy as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, he might have heard of him because, this was a
real folk hero.
Super folk hero, and he died in his bed, an old man. And
wow,
that's not the right way for him to die.
But he was being attacked at the time.
That's right.
Well, he was a troll. He was the prototypical 16th century troll. He just didn't give a fuck. He just I can't, you know, I've got a fondness for him. I shouldn't like him, but I do.
That feels like most figures in history, to be perfectly honest. Now, we always ask our guests what they are worst at in the world. What is it for you?
I cannot go on a tour. Like, I cannot be on a guided tour of somewhere.
Good. That seems appropriate. Do you heckle?
I heckle.
My footnotes.
When I was a small child, I came to England for the first time, and something went off in my brain, and I just became a history fiend, and I'd read everything I could. I'd sort of been taking brochures and leaflets from every corner and buying books at all the little English heritage places. So, and it got to the stage where I was reading up ahead of where I was going, and I think it was Salisbury.
It's very good stained glass, I believe.
Yeah,
in Salisbury.
And I think the spire is 123 metres.
So
tall.
I hear.
Yeah, so we were doing a tour there long before the deteriorations between relations between Russia and the United Kingdom deteriorated to such an extent. But anyway, I started giving the tour. I took over as a 9-year-old, and to my parents' undying shame and embarrassment. And I'm sure
like
that
Jesus teaching in the temple.
I'm sure that 90% of what I was saying was complete bullshit, but it was.
But you sold it with confidence. That's
yeah,
what
I sold it with confidence. And then the American tourists are going, oh, look at the little kid, oh, little limey kid.
To be fair, I went to Trinity College Dublin, where there are official university-sanctioned tours by students who wear their gowns, who stand at the front gate, and they take the bookings. And I'm pretty sure I had friends who would say, I'll do a tour for you for a tenner. I'll do a tour. Yeah. And just would make up all the stuff. Around. The great thing is every student in Trinity gets... Your student card gets you access to the library, the long room library, which is the famous library, and they use it in Star Wars and in Harry Potter and all these things. It's where the Book of Kells is. So we can just skip the queue. So you'd have people who'd go, give me fiver, you're at the back of the queue, I'll take you in right away.
Very entrepreneurial. Yeah. Like, so I went to Jesus College, Oxford, and...
Where Jesus went.
That was the opening line of the bullshit tour I used to do. Just like, he came here to study carpentry in the year 18 AD.
Back when it was a polytechnic. Yeah. Worst and epidemic, or you could interpret this in many different ways, and I'm pretty sure we probably will. We're going to start with Ben.
Cool. Okay. Just a tiny little bit of local pride for me to start off. I wander down a Wikipedia back alley of something called an epizootic, which is basically an epidemic, but in animals. And I mostly liked it because it's such a charming word. You know, something is epizootic if it's in a local population and panzootic if it's global.
Of course, because dem for people and so zoo for animals.
Yeah, exactly. And there was an epizootic outbreak in 1926 and 1927 called Newcastle's disease. And it was a disease that attacked a particular type of bird, and bizarrely it broke out in Java in Indonesia and Newcastle upon Tyne.
Wow.
And I don't know, one guy. Well, it's either
one very specific boat journey.
Yeah, it's either that or the birds that had a really weird migration pattern. But I don't know, they sort of like lived in Newcastle, had a bit too much Newcastle brown ale, and went a little bit too far.
What are the symptoms?
So it basically it attacks cells fairly indiscriminately. But what's fascinating was it was part of the disease ended up being used as a cancer treatment because they managed to persuade the cells to attack tumour cells. So from this fairly unpleasant epidemic, epizootic, that killed several thousand birds, there may actually be a treatment for cancer in the end.
Cool.
Continuing an optimistic trend for now, I'm going to tell you the amazing story of Eugene Lazowski. Have you guys heard of him?
No.
So he was a member of the Polish resistance during World War II, and he was a doctor. and along with his friend Stanislav Matulevich, he found there was a way of injecting healthy people with a vaccine for typhus that would mean that when they were tested for typhus, they would test positive, but they didn't actually have it.
Oh.
And
okay.
And basically,
curiously
what it was
specific.
Yeah, yeah.
Hang on. But what would happen if they did have it? What would they test negative?
No. It didn't sort of like invert everything.
But then, if they test positive, how do they know if they're actually positive or negative?
Because they wouldn't then go on and die from the typhus.
Oh, okay, because I mean, I feel like you don't need a vaccination. If someone dies of typhus, you go, okay, they had typhus. I don't think you need the vaccination period in between.
Well, what's the practical application?
Yes.
hear me out, lads. Yeah. Hear me out. This isn't a Baldrick cunning plan.
Currently, I'm out.
Basically, what he did was the Nazis were, you'll be unsurprised to learn, quite germophobic. Because.
Germophilic, presumably. Yeah. Germans.
But because of the whole master race thing, and wanting to seem very, very pure.
Yeah.
They were quite, it's quite a lazy shorthand to say OCD, but they were very afraid of disease in any way, particularly members of the Waffen-SS, because they were built up to be this very, very purest of the pure.
Yeah.
And what Lazovsky wanted to do was protect the Jewish population around him. Here's the thing. If Jews were found there when he did it, it was in the early 1940s, to have the disease, they weren't shipped off to the camps then, they were just gunned down immediately. So what Lazovsky did was he injected this fake typhus into non-Jewish members of the village. So the Nazis would turn up and go, oh shit, this place needs to be quarantined.
Right.
And would quarantine the whole area.
Leave us.
And thus sort of incubating the Jews, I guess, surrounded by these people.
So no one actually had typhus, but it looked like they did.
Yes,
and they
exactly.
Just leave the place alone.
It's not worth the risk.
Yeah.
Clever. He saved over 8,000 Jewish men, women, and children.
Well done,
like,
Eugene Lazovsky.
Yeah, like way more than Schindler. Not suggesting that Schindler was a slacker. But,
That's what we're taking from this. Oscar Schindler was
points
shit.
For ingenuity.
Yeah.
And what was lovely? There's a quote from him saying, "I was not able to fight with a gun or a sword, but I found a way to scare the Germans." And the best bit, the Germans eventually sort of like cottoned on to what might be happening. So in 1943, when they turned up to inspect, because you would expect that there should be signs of epidemic and people dying, they turned up, and what he did was Lazovsky took all of the oldest and sickest men in the community. He put them in dirty clothes. He lined them up in the filthiest huts. Meanwhile, he then got all the villagers to throw a massive party for all the German soldiers turning up with vodka and loads of Polish sausage, and said, "Oh, we're so happy to see you. Come and have a party." And what happened instead, the Germans were partying, and so they sent the youngest, most inexperienced doctors to examine these old, filthy men in these old, filthy huts. And basically, as soon as they got there, it was like, "Oh God, they're covered in lice. Oh, no thanks." And surely, yeah, they're absolutely full of typhus, and ran off. So he
Amazing.
Managed to keep the Germans off the scent again. So he is an absolute hero.
Hero. We should know more about him. He's great.
Complete
yes.
success.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I know.
About this
so
guy.
Why'd you bring him up?
Because it was too good a story not
to
tell.
Balance the dark with the light somehow.
Yeah. So let's bring some darkness. Cooties. a word that we don't really use in British Isles or Ireland. Australia? Cooties a thing?
Nope.
It's very American teen movie stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. The word actually comes from either the Philippines, Maori culture, or Malaysia, Indonesia, because the kutu is a parasitic biting insect.
Uh-huh.
But it was first used not by Americans, but in the World War I trenches.
Oh, right.
And
are they
was,
lice? Is that what they are?
Pretty much, yeah. They were nicknamed the arithmetical bugs because they add to our troubles, subtract from our pleasures, divide our attention, and multiply like hell.
The 1910s.
Yeah. But I think for them, the real outbreak, the real epidemic of cooties was in a board game. Because in 1948, after World War II, a board game company developed the Game of Cootie, where you build a three-dimensional cootie toy, and it was listed in one of Time magazine's 100 Greatest Toys.
When? That year? Or, like, recently?
No, recently.
No way! Yeah.
By 1952, it had sold 1.2 million copies.
How have we not heard of this? Why did the hula hoop last and not this thing?
Yeah, God only knows. Well, it lasted into the 1980s. Well, it had a reboot in the 1980s, where as well as building the bug, you can add on things like sneakers and inline skates. but it's, I mean, I don't know about you, Mike. Me and Barry are massive board game fans.
Yes.
Terrible mechanics in this board game. Mm. You roll the dice, and if you roll the right number, you put a piece of the bug together.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Pretty uninspiring.
Ah, the 1950s. Yeah. That's going to be the subtitle to every one of these stories.
Yeah, I think so. Well, next you're going to be going, Japan. Because next I looked at Japanese, Korean, and Chinese, like, fandom, both of real people and also sort of figures in anime and manga. And there is a phrase called Hanahaki. And what Hanahaki is when a character in these things experiences unrequited love, and so a symptom of that is they begin to cough up petals of flowers which are growing in their lungs.
Oh.
And eventually so many flowers and petals grow in their lungs that they die and they choke on them. And so
tell me it's happened in real life.
No, it's not happened in real life. That would be incredible, wouldn't it?
I have some doubts.
Yeah. We're going to go back to the Far East for my choice. Mm-hmm. But the two other things that I looked at, one was I went to sort of early modern Europe. And there was a really bizarre epidemic that has been noted in a brilliant book called the Malleus Maleficum.
Maleficarum. Yeah. Ooh, yeah. I know this one. I love this one.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant.
I feel like we've mentioned it before.
The Hammer of Witches.
Yeah.
The Hammer of Witches. Is that what it means?
Yes.
Oh, what was the Hammer of Witches?
Well, that's what it is. It's the book. No. It's a witch hunter's guide.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
right.
If you'd read the guide, you would know, you know, the signs of a witch and, you know,
how to
what would distinguish
them,
her, you know, what kind of strange beasties they consort with.
I love the idea of, like, treating a witch like you would a fly, and instead of a rolled up newspaper you just get the Hammer of Witches and bonk him on the head.
It was written by a guy, I think his name was Heinrich Kramer, and he was basically a sex pest priest. He kicked out of a number of dioceses because of various things.
The 1500s.
Yeah.
And
yeah, thou
today.
Too, yeah.
Yeah.
So he basically, the misogyny and the hatred of both his era and obviously this individual, because he wasn't a well guy, manifested in this book, which was it was very lucky in that it came out around the time that books were beginning to be printed.
Yeah, of course.
And it was an absolute sensation.
It was printed
20 different times in various parts of Europe over the next century. And for a while, you know, witch persecutions, there was a little bump, but it didn't go too crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next century, people started picking up this book, which was, you know, over the, you know, had the patina of age over it. People sort of knew that it was it's an old book, it must have some essential truths in it. So,
yes.
You know, in the 17th century, people in Germany were reading through the Malleus Maleficarum and sort of saying, then Anna down the street, she does this, she does this, and it was, it helped drive the big witch persecutions, of which there were like four or five, particularly in Germany, which was the big thing.
And it's sort of, the way you're describing it, it sort of feels like the early modern version of OK Magazine and Hello, because instead of, like, nowadays they'd have, oh, is she beach body ready? No, look at all these bits that suggest she isn't.
Yeah.
But instead it's like, is this woman a witch? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Yes, exactly. So,
well, the two things I found in it, one was that in 1491 there was an outbreak of nuns pretending to be cats and dogs.
Yes, it's so good.
It's so brilliant. Weird.
Yeah.
So there was a French convent where the nuns for several hours a day would start meowing like cats. And
how did I miss this one?
It's so good.
It's so weird. They would also. What's brilliant is that some of the nuns would also start woofing like dogs, and the dogs would start chasing the cats.
Yeah.
Great. They also started tweeting like birds, and they only stopped when police turned up and basically threatened them. And it's similar to some other epidemics that we might talk about, but it's basically a version of mass hysteria.
Yeah. Like, I've got the quote from it, actually.
Go for it.
So there's it's an account written by a guy called Justus Friedrich Hecker in Epidemics of the Middle Ages, which was written in the 1800s, but he's recounting having read about this in earlier works. And he says, "I've read in a good medical work that a nun in a very large convent in France began to meow like a cat. Shortly afterwards, the other nuns also meowed. At last, all the nuns meowed together every day at a certain time for several hours. The whole surrounding Christian neighbourhood heard with equal chagrin and astonishment this daily cat concert, which did not cease until all the nuns were informed that a company of soldiers were placed by the police before the entrance of the convent, and that they were provided with rods and would continue whipping them until they promised not to meow anymore."
Yeah, I mean, Sound of Music in the 15th century would have been weird. The hills are alive with the meows of music. The sound of music. Damn it. Yeah, and I suppose I should probably talk about this one, which I think you've looked at as well, Barry, because it links to it, is 1962, the Tanganyika laughing epidemic.
Yeah.
Do you know about this?
Yes, I know about this one.
It's so good.
So again, it's mass psychotic illness. So it's it was an all-girls boarding school, and on one day in January 1962, three of them started laughing uncontrollably. Very quickly, over 90 children were laughing hysterically, and by the end of March, the school had to be shut down.
Yeah, it only had about 160 students. That's easily more than half of them already affected by this.
And then, I mean, this is...
No staff, all students affected.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It's all kids, 12 to 18-year-olds.
And they did, and I sort of understand why they did this, but they basically went, right, go back to your individual villages and try and hopefully the people in those villages...
Separate you, you'll calm down.
Yeah, it's what you would do with laughter, but it's not what you could do with a goddamn epidemic, because it then spread to all of these villages as well. It also led to things such as pain, fainting, flatulence, rashes... crying and random screaming.
Random screaming.
Which would probably flatulence would probably generate more laughter.
Yeah.
It's like hearing someone vomit and then you begin vomiting. Yeah. It keeps going and going.
And then it spread among young children, and then they went back to school and to different schools. So then it spread to other schools. That was the thing. They'd go back to their own villages and meet other school children from other schools, and that would spread among them as well. It was bonkers.
Have you watched the videos of it? It's really quite creepy.
Yeah.
And it's because this phenomenon has been found in places like Kosovo, Afghanistan, South Africa. It's clearly related to stress or PTSD, because Tanganyika had just got its independence, and it goes on to become Tanzania, doesn't it?
Yes,
In the end, so it's clearly connected to that. But
they think actually one person I read talking about it said the newfound self-confidence of the nation and its independence suddenly put the adults in the nation were putting bigger expectations on their kids to make something of the new state. And it often affects, a lot of these mass hysterias always affect the sort of the people of low status, people who are under stress and strain, like the dancing plagues were always like lower class people in very strict religious areas.
And they're starting to think that with those dancing plagues, I'm surprised that nobody mentioned that.
We've talked about them before, actually, on a couple of parts.
The dancing plague in Strasbourg is the one that they have been looking at for many decades.
Yeah.
And they've moved way beyond the traditional explanation, which was ergo poisoning.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now they do think it was a combination of religious hysteria, because obviously you've got the forces of the Reformation at this time.
Yeah.
People are putting up pamphlets. You had, like, I think 6 or 7 different prominent apocalyptic preachers.
Yes.
preaching from the... I don't know if you've been to Strasbourg, but there's a church... fucking 50 metres.
It was the heart of Calvinism and Anabaptism,
wasn't it? So you had a lot of the guys that would go on and cause a lot of trouble as Anabaptists later on. So religious hysteria, everybody is completely sure that the world's about to end. But also there'd been a series of really terrible plagues. Harvests.
Yes.
So nobody had anything to eat, and everybody was working incredibly long hours. And it was a time of great change. I mean, obviously... Strasbourg was turning into like a mercantile powerhouse at the time, so everybody's
it's being overworked,
working ridiculous hours. Nobody's working, and they're pretty sure that the world's about to end.
Yeah.
So wasn't there? It's like during the Anabaptist time. Mm. I think there was either an eclipse or there was like a blood moon that they didn't know was coming, because they weren't particularly great astronomers yet. But obviously, if you've got all of this crucible of awfulness going on that Mike's described, and then you get a blood moon eclipse, that's going to send people nuts.
Yes, it is.
But it's funny. Yeah, on this show, we seem to find sort of like mass hysteria in the working class, and then in the upper class, it's just one person does it all themselves. One person, usually a Habsburg.
Yes. The laughing plague was 1,000 people affected by it at the end of it all. It's mad. And lasted up to 18 months in some people's cases. Yeah, it's bonkers.
Yeah, it sort of sounds like a sketch from The Goodies, but it's actually really bleak.
Yes, yeah. With the director's cut of the Laughing Policeman song.
Yeah.
That's produced by Meatloaf.
We are going to go, for my suggestion, to the Far East, but via The Witcher's Hammer again, because one thing I didn't mention, this is my favourite thing from The Witcher's Hammer, is that witches were often accused of stealing men's genitals and then hiding them in a box made by the devil. And whilst in that box...
Oh, yeah, big deal, yeah.
No, that's a big deal.
That's
big
the thing, it wasn't a fringe thing.
Yeah. That was mainstream thought.
Witches would steal your potency.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you couldn't get it up, it could be a witch.
Oh.
Yeah. But I'm sorry, this doesn't normally happen to me. It's clearly a witch.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I've been watching far too much Sabrina.
Yeah.
But there's a difference between going, they're stealing your potency and actually taking your wanger.
Yeah.
And my favourite DL is the witches would, they would stick it in a box and they would feed it oats and corn. just like a little class pet.
That's so creepy.
Yeah. But for my suggestion, we are going to the Far East. We're going to talk about Koro, which is connected to this, which is a very, very strange phenomenon.
It's so odd.
So it's been recorded most famously in Singapore, but also in the Guangdong province of China. That will become appropriate in a moment. And it's interesting that the years it kicked off there, 48, 55, 66, 72, and 84, 85, many of them are eras of major upheaval in Chinese history, either the creation of the state or the Cultural Revolution. And what it is a... you become convinced that your penis, nipples, and if you're a woman, vulva, are shrinking and disappearing into your body.
Genital retraction syndrome.
Mm. Yeah. Yes. And many men were admitted to A&E with clamps and rubber bands already attached to their genitals because they were afraid that it was going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's weird because I don't know whether this is true or not, but I remember reading when I was very like a teenager about, this is in Japan, but samurais having the ability to retract their penis inside their body as a defence mechanism against it being cut off.
Yeah, there is mythology about it. It's a very cultural thing because there are stories about it in myth and legend in Japanese and Chinese culture, this Far Eastern culture, as we call. And so it seems the majority of the cases are there and in Africa. It's really a Western thing.
Yes, yeah, no, it's been found in like Nigeria, Cameroon, the Ivory Coast, Senegal and Benin. The difference there was that mobs of people were attacked, accused of stealing the genitals. So it's a callback to the Witcher's Hammer in the Far East. Many people thought, or it's suspected that it was don't know how true this is, that it was caused by a pork vaccine because a pig was found dead with a retracted penis.
Yeah, that was in Singapore in 1967. Yep. There was meat of pigs were injected for swine flu. And so they were convinced that it was something to do with this. And one hospital in one day got 97 people self-admitting with what they thought was penis retraction because they'd eaten pork or they'd eaten in this restaurant where it had been.
It's so strange. And my favourite thing about it, which is a callback to a previous episode, quite a lot of the people in Singapore were prescribed tiger, deer or seal penis wine.
Yeah.
A classic Far Eastern remedy. And the other thing they were diagnosed as having was that they had too much fox spirit. And that's what had caused it. And so in order to remove the fox spirit, they had to be surrounded by gongs that were beaten in a certain rhythm to remove the fox spirit from
them. That sounds more bonkers than some of the rubber bands to your penis, or some women to stop their nipples retracting would put iron pins through their nipples.
No thanks.
Self-pierce to make sure they didn't go in.
Yeah, so I just thought that, if it's true, it's horrible. Mm. If it's not true, it's a weird mass hysteria.
Yeah.
Mm. And that the what you are prescribed to deal with it all sounds horrible.
Yeah.
So for all those reasons, Koro, genital disappearing syndrome, is my suggestion.
When you invited me on the podcast and you gave me the job of finding the worst epidemic in history, I was of two minds. Did they want me to come up with the most inept response to a plague?
Yes.
Or did they want me to come up with the most pitifully easily remedied epidemic, because there's quite a few that with one small change fix it? Or do you want just the ones that are the most lethal?
Yeah, there's lots of ways you can look at it.
But okay, let me talk about two ones that were very easy just to get rid of.
Okay.
Okay. Well, cholera was a huge, huge problem throughout the 19th century.
Yeah.
I mean, it's stretching back into history. There's been regular epidemics, but people living in close proximity in the Victorian era, sharing water sources was completely, it was like the, you know, the Hilton. for cholera bacteria. Now, cholera is a disease that is spread through water.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
So that's how you catch it. And London, not having any kind of real sanitation system prior to the 1850s, really got it in waves probably about every 20 years. I think there was one in 1820. I think there was another one around 1835, I think. But the one that we all remember is in the 1850s, around 1854, mm-hmm. about the time of the Great Stink, where the Thames was so disgustingly full of, you know, crap.
Yeah, yeah. It's the downside of building, throughout human history, we build our cities on rivers, and then we have all this polluted water flowing through them.
There was very poor sanitation, no real water source that was shared or, you know, that was checked for any kind of, you know, whether it was potable or not.
Yeah.
And the epidemic that we all remember, and there's a very good book about this called The Ghost Map, if you're listening, it was on Broad Street over in Soho.
Yep.
And basically people started dying in great numbers, particularly women and children. And a guy called Joseph Snow started to look at where the deaths were happening.
Is it Joseph or John?
John, sorry, just yes. John. It's John, sorry about that. One of those things.
He doesn't know nothing.
Yeah.
I know who I'm thinking of. I'll get to that in a second. Yes. So John Snow is looking at who is dying in the houses, right? And he's actually color-coding the houses.
Tracing where they go.
Where it goes. Yeah. And in the end, he found the biggest concentration of mortality around one particular water pump.
Yeah.
Okay. Because on Broad Street. So he takes the handle off, and it's over.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Right. Yes.
That's such a sort of Arthurian sword from the stone, but in a medical way.
I can't remember if the pump is still there, but there's definitely a John Snow pump on the street.
Now. Yeah. Yes. There's a pump statue. It's not there. It's a couple of streets over. And another one. Childbed fever was pretty. I'm calling it an epidemic because it was basically caused by the same. Bacteria, Streptococcus, and basically that would affect just women who had just given birth, and if they sort of were bleeding, then and they had people who were, you know, helping them deliver who hadn't washed their hands.
Yes,
they were in big trouble. They would, you know, women were dying a couple of days after giving birth, and this was happening in great numbers.
Yeah,
and it was actually happening in huge numbers amongst women who gave birth in a hospital. Now, hospitals were supposed to be this place where you'd go and you would have access to the latest medical technology. But also there were a lot of these places that that would give you free medical treatment because they were sort of funded by charitable institutions.
Mm-hmm.
But still, mortality rates were through the roof until, I think it was the mid-19th century, there was a guy called Ignaz Semmelweis.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the idea of washing your hands.
What a radical.
Mortality rates in his ward, which he did this, after washing your hands in a chlorine solution and washing your instruments, mortality rates went down from 18% to 3% overnight.
It's so incredible.
And he was mocked for it. And everybody was like, this is ridiculous, Ignaz, go away. And he sort of died in obscurity and you know, feeling like he had spent the rest of his life being mocked. But
But
eventually his ideas... kicked on, and we got with the program.
It's like a much more consequential version of the guy who decided to put the hole in the bottom of the basketball basket.
Yeah.
They used to just climb up and get it back out of the basket again.
Yeah.
I think with this guy as well, I'm fairly certain I've read that it was because it wasn't just as bad as he helps with the delivery of one baby and then goes to the delivery of another. He would literally be doing a dissection of a cadaver.
That's right.
And then
go
into the birth wards. And I've read a couple of articles that suggest that for a long time before he actually implemented this, the midwives were going, mate, Wash your hands.
You've got to stop this.
Yeah, exactly. Who's like, tush and fine, woman, I'm not going to listen to you. So actually, the real heroes of this are the nameless midwives.
Right, and my wife, who's a very stern German, was make sure that you mention the women. Thank you for reminding me. Right, okay,
that saved your journey back to Luton.
Yes, that's right. Those are two sort of disease epidemics that were fixed very easily. Now, let's talk about diseases that were... the response to them was quite awful.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so we know about the Black Death in... Well, actually, there's been a couple of outbreaks of Black Death.
Yeah.
Or bubonic plague. The bacteria is called Yersinia pestis. Mm. The epidemic that we talk about the most occurred in... First victims were in 1347, and that was over in the Crimea, and it was brought over. The traditional story is that it came in one ship to Genoa in Italy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But recently, historians are sort of finding more accounts of various ships wrecked on the coast around there with nobody on it and people taking the stuff off and got sick.
Oh, so, that almost feels like sort of a sci-fi or a horror story.
Right,
like ghost ships crashing on the coast.
Yeah, so
that's a horrible image. You're trapped on this ship with this disease just killing people right, left, and centre.
Isn't it like one of the Alien films? Like,
yes, of course.
Because there was a siege at Kafra in Crimea. Yeah. And, you know, all of these ships are like trying to be the last one out. It's like, we got out. It's like,
we're done, and the
flea, you know, close up on the flea's face going,
and I'm sure everyone's, it's the fleas on the rats, not the rats themselves, is the thing now that everyone's aware of.
Right. So, okay, within 8 months, it's spread over most of Europe. And in fact, I think in 2 years afterwards, it was like it had reached Bergen in Norway. So it had got very, very far. It killed 25 million people.
When I was
25 to 50 million.
Yes,
Top estimate
is 50.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Right.
When you learn sort of early modern Renaissance history in school, I never got taught or never really got mentioned the fact that the Black Death happened beforehand, and it feels such an important part of that story because all this sort of the apocalyptic cults, it's really easy to think that if you remember your granddad dying of the Black Death or you've heard stories of it.
Mm. Yeah, and it's easy for us to make fun of something like, say, SARS, which everyone thought was going to like kill the planet and kills a few hundred people. But back then, the idea of a disease wiping out half the planet was completely credible.
Yeah,
right. Right, so in terms of the response to the Black Death...
Where were the World Health Organization on this?
Well, no, I mean, okay, so really, it's fuck-ups on all levels, to be honest. For a start, the blame was cast on the conjunction of the planets. There's a couple of French sources. I think some from Paris. I can't remember the name of the guy, but he was talking about, Venus is over here and Mars is over here. And look,
it
was actually really on point. He was saying, go hide yourselves somewhere. Just don't stick around the cities. You've got to get away.
Huh.
But his rationale was that this planet was here and this planet was here. So, you know, points for him.
So it would be great if you didn't have to show your workings out.
Yeah. No one listened anyway. There was also the idea that it was the miasma. And the miasma is, you know, the smell. So that contagion was spread by smell.
Yes,
I love that because I love like how in physics there was this idea of the ether, which people had, which eventually got dispelled in the 18th, maybe 19th century, that light needed a thing to go through, and miasma is like the biology version of it.
The miasma theory carried through to the 19th century. When they were talking about cholera, they thought it was the smell. That was giving people the cholera.
Because it kind really of makes sense. Like if you're in Rome,
and
every couple of summers they have it's quite swampy ground, and every couple of summers they have a cholera outbreak, and everyone flees the city. There's always popes dying from cholera, that's why they have Castel Gandolfo as the Pope's country retreat, so he can just not be in Rome for a bit.
Mm.
And if the place is stinking and lots of people are dying, you go, okay, these two must be linked somehow.
Yeah. So actually, you got to say, they had something going, as long as you didn't have to show your...
They joined the wrong dots.
Joined the wrong dots, but points for trying.
Yeah.
One response from people, and there's quite a few Italian sources that talk about this, particularly around Siena, was that people, and Florence, that people would go out into the countryside and say, hey, come to my place.
Oh, no.
let's have a drink, let's party, because tomorrow we would die. And the Decameron by Boccaccio is...
Uh-huh. Yes.
That's where this comes from, a bunch of people telling stories during the plague. But you know, for many of these occasions, people coming into close proximity with one another, they would be bringing the fleas with them,
which was
the primary vector here.
Yeah, and now these things. And suddenly it's gone from an alien movie to a zombie apocalypse movie, hasn't it?
That's right, that's right. And you know, so they had the parties and they would take them back, and this is how a lot of the nobility would sort of and they'd take it back to their particular sort of little walled towns, and they would spread, like, you know, it was like a little petri dish.
Yeah.
There were also the flagellants, which you've alluded to. Oh, I think you did.
Didn't you?
Apocalyptic cults.
Oh, well,
the flagellants thought that the plague was a punishment from God.
Yes,
so,
of course.
They're the ones who go around the countryside wearing, you know, with their tops off, whipping themselves with the blood.
They're the ones who wouldn't like gay marriage nowadays because flooding, apparently.
They're the crazy zealots.
Yeah.
But one thing about the plague is that the Yersinia pestis, it eventually sort of morphed into three different kinds of plagues.
Yeah,
so there's your bubonic plague, which is, you know, the one buboes under your armpits and on your neck. There's septicemic. Now, septicemic plague comes from when you're exposed to blood.
Oh, no.
Yes. And septicemic blood causes a lot of hemorrhaging.
Oh, no.
So if you're infected with the septicemic plague and you're sort of running around and you're whipping yourself on the back.
Oh, no.
Right? And, you know, people are sort of tearing strips off these guys' robes to sort of...
God.
Yes. So that's awful, isn't it? So, the flagellants are sometimes said to have spread...
Of course they did.
Because they'd walk around, they go through the countryside.
Splashing blood on you.
Splashing blood, yes. And, you know, some of them also, the third variant of the Black Death was pneumonic plague. And that comes from sneezing. So if one of these guys has sort of copped it and got the sniffle, and the pneumonic plague is pretty much 100% lethal. You could survive the Black Death.
Yeah.
You could survive your bog standard bubonic plague. You had a slightly less... good chance of septicemic plague. Yeah. But pneumonic plague, you drown in your own blood.
I suppose the Hollywood version, the bubonic plague, is the most visually impressive to us. Right, that's why we remember it, I suppose.
Right, yeah. So the flagellants and, you know, these countryside parties were horrible. they were the worst possible thing that they could do.
Yeah.
And so that was often cited as one of the major ways in which the plague would have spread through beyond Italy, through France and up into England. Yes, and it came up with all these strange beliefs grew up around the Black Death. And there's one in Germany, which I think it's particularly gothy and dark and quite horrible. They started to believe that the plague was caused by something called the Pest Jungfrau, or the Plague Maiden.
Oh, wow.
She was a ghost that would walk around with a sort of little blue flame above her head, and she'd be knocking on doors seeking help. And if you let her in, you'd be, you know, you'd get the plague.
Oh, God, it's the Ring.
It's literally
Sadako from the Ring.
It's the Ring. And, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about this. There must have been some people who were going to other people's doors sort of saying, you know, help me, I need some help.
Yeah.
You know, some poor sick person already. And that sort of morphed into this folk belief about the... the spread of the plague. Yeah.
Wow.
So that's another thing that's particularly awful. And we're talking about plague responses. I can't let this one pass. As I said, you know, I sort of take on the alt-right a lot. And a lot of the stuff that they come up with is just recycled stuff, some of it from the Black Death.
Yeah.
Go on.
So, during the Black Death, particularly in places like... again, I'm talking about Germany, I'm talking about along the Rhine, places like Czechoslovakia, some bits of eastern France. People believed it was the Jews who were responsible for the Black Death. They would basically sort of come along and say, well, okay, these guys in their own little community, let's forget that they're dying at the same rate as everybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, they're, you know, they live apart from us. They must be responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And they came up with all these particular stories. There's the blood libel, which is a particular horrible sort of lie that's perpetuated about Jewish people. And also poisoning wells, poisoning the water supply, that was another one. And it led to these vast purges through areas of France and Germany, where basically the populace, who were already sick, they were already experiencing the illness, and they're all covered in fleas, would go along and, you know, attack the Jewish community. I used to live near a town where they would rather than let themselves be torn apart by the crowds, a place called Esslingen, they put themselves in their synagogue and burned themselves alive.
Oh God!
So yeah, sorry to bring the darkness, but
no.
But this was a huge thread throughout the course of this Black Death.
Yeah.
The Jewish people who in some not, you know, it wasn't official church doctrine, but in a lot of places they'd hear every weekend that, you know, that killed Christ and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, they were the first to be blamed.
And also they would back it up with faked evidence. What they would be the Jewish ghetto, and they would either have the body of an already dead child, or some people would kill a child, whack it over the ghetto walls, and then go in and go, "You Jews, you've killed this kid." There's a story of the great rabbi of Prague, a guy called the Maharal of Prague, where they tried to frame him by putting a vial of blood inside the ark where all the Torah scrolls were kept.
Right, right.
Wow.
And they basically brought the police to his synagogue, and he got tipped off. Mm. And there's the scene, as I've had it described to me, is he opens the ark where the Torah scrolls are with his back turned as the police are coming in, and he sees this vial of blood, and he looks at it and goes, "It ain't kosher, but I'm going to have to down it." So he necks the blood and throws away the vial. Wow. So he's able to go, "No blood here, officer, but I will happily answer all your questions.
But I am a vampire."
Yeah.
yeah. So, I mean, in a lot of areas, they'd been formed for that.
The
blood libel. I mean, Norwich, Lincoln,
oh, yes,
Bury St. Edmunds, they've all got their saints that were supposedly killed by the Jewish community.
Mm. Is that
child
be,
saints, yeah.
That'll have been right. Edward threw the Jews out. It was Edward II, I think, threw the Jews out of England.
Yeah, 1290.
That's the one.
Right. And so these pogroms had sort of essentially... Yeah, this was... I mean, on one hand, yes, they're an awful atrocity. On the other hand, these, you know, huge acts of violence destroying infrastructure, because, you know, they're not just sort of targeting one part of the, you know, a couple of people. They're sort of targeting a whole part of the town.
Yeah.
It was just weakening the whole fabric of the town in attacking, you know, what they saw as the other.
Yeah.
They'd be weakening the entire fabric of the town. And
I feel like there's a lesson to be learned from that, but I can't quite put my finger on it, and I'm sure no one ever will.
No.
Jesus Christ. 1,000 years we've been doing this shit.
So, yeah, I mean...
Which is also how I feel about this podcast. Yeah.
If you can't, you can't go past that original outbreak of the Black Death for really, really shitty responses to the plague.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that there were... The previous outbreak, there was a huge one in 541 and 542.
The plague of Justinian,
The Justinian plague. And that was killing, I think, 2,000 people a day.
A 100 million people, or, if you like, half the planet.
I've heard a quarter, but half the planet. Yeah.
Top estimates.
Right.
Half
so
the
that
planet,
was
yeah.
that was sort of circling around the east of the eastern part of the Eastern Roman Empire. But
also, you work in advertising. Yeah. Justinian needs to get a better PR team if he's called the Plague of Justinian. He's like, "Guys, we need to shake this tag."
Well, it's funny, right? Because the Antonine Plague, which they think was smallpox during the reign of Marcus Aurelius. Everybody loves Marcus Aurelius. Everybody remembers Meditations. Hey, that's Stoic.
Yeah, philosopher, emperor.
Philosopher king. Nobody ever sort of links him to the 15-year outbreak.
He managed to call it the Antonine rather than the Aurelian plague.
Yeah, yeah.
But also because he was a famous Stoic. So there's a plague. Shit happens.
Yeah, it's fine.
So that was a doozy too. I mean, that arguably led to cracks appearing in the Roman Empire in relation to their ability to hold on to their borders.
Yes.
In that they couldn't sufficiently keep the number of troops that they needed in Germania and the East, and that would eventually lead to their downfall.
Yeah. So, like the seeds are planted a millennium early.
Yeah. And just while we're talking about that, I mean, I think, you know, you're asking me about what I think my worst plague is the fact that they think that the Antonine Plague was smallpox, based on the physician Galen's accounts, and he's talking about between becoming ill, there was about a fortnight.
Yes.
So, you know, first you'd get the sweats, you'd get dizzy, you'd get really thirsty, and then only after a couple of days in would you get the sort of pustules.
Yeah, the bumps and stuff.
Yeah, right. So the thing that I think makes that particular, or smallpox, a particularly horrible plague and one of the worst of all time is that incubation period. You've got 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Now, in the Roman Empire, you could go a fair distance in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You could be halfway across France or, you know, Gaul. You could be halfway across Germania.
Yeah.
And because smallpox is traditionally passed by, it can be passed by touch.
Yes.
It can be
passed by
sneezing. It can be, there's a number of vectors for it. So that, to me, makes it particularly terrifying to me.
It is one of the most remarkable things humanity has ever done, is wiped out smallpox.
Yes.
It's one of those great acts of international cooperation that we're sadly lacking.
But also, we don't notice this. It's one of those things because you're not being torn apart by wolves at every single moment, you don't realise how lucky you are not to be being torn apart by wolves.
Yes.
I think the thing about smallpox is that it's always burbled away in the background. It's not as... I hate to say this, it's not as flashy as Black Death. I mean, obviously you get a face full of weeping pustules, but at the same time, it hasn't spread as quickly, and there is more of a survivability. So, I mean, this is sort of dragging it more towards my worst epidemic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, just to give you a flavour of how shit scared people are of smallpox, in, I think it was 1978, a photographer at the Birmingham, the teaching hospital there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. A woman named Janet Parker was responsible for taking pictures of the slides.
Yes, yeah.
And she came down sick with all the classic symptoms of smallpox. And everybody's going, how the hell did that happen?
Because that's about a couple of years after the eradication. Yeah,
a couple of years after it's been eradicated. So she's like, how the hell did she get smallpox? And they went through the entire laboratory and they searched everything and they sort of, in the end, they found out that it sort of had gone through a ventilation hood and just sort of basically just dropped down on her.
Yeah.
Now, she died, unfortunately, and they were so scared of dealing with her body that, you know, she wasn't allowed to be put into the morgue. She was basically dumped in a bag full of sawdust and very, very, very strong antibacterial solutions.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you know, it's a virus, but you know, there was all sorts of, nothing could live in there. And when they buried her, obviously they cremated her. They couldn't
Want to put her in the ground.
Right. So they had a police guard in case the hearse crashed.
Wow.
That's how terrified they were of it spreading, because there is no cure.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
There's no cure. You can be vaccinated for it, and that's obviously, we defeated it that way. But once it's out, once people are starting to show the signs of it, then, you know. So her mother also got sick from it.
Oh, God.
Right, and she survived. And, you know, there's a ton, you know, I think there was one or two other people that showed signs of it. But the fact that they were just basically quarantined and not let it out of their house for 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's one hell of an alternative timeline story of having a smallpox outbreak in Britain during the height of punk.
Yes.
That's a comic with book
everyone,
I want to read.
Everyone's spitting everywhere.
Yes!
And obviously, I mean, it has such an effect on the popular imagination that, you know, that smallpox was such a killer that, you know, there are only two vials, or two places in the world. There's one. We don't know in Russia where it is. The CDC in America and we don't know in Russia have the last two cultures.
Of course they both have one each.
Right, so if you're asking me what I think the worst epidemic of all time is, I think I'm going to have to say smallpox.
Well, I feel miserable after that.
Shall I tell you some stupid plagues instead?
Tell us some stupid plagues.
I'm going to start with the top five, though, just
great,
because I did look at what are the worst actual biggest killing plagues of all time. We've mentioned most of them by now. The plague of Justinian from 541-42, 100 million people is said, top estimate, about half the planet's population, which is ridiculous. The Black Death, then, I said, maybe up to 50 million people. That's the 1340s outbreak of that. HIV AIDS, 1960 still to today, but obviously the peak in the 1980s, killed 39 million people so far.
39 million.
Million people, even with modern medicine, as we like to think of it.
I'm just going to interject. That's a plague that has been enabled by hatred and bigotry.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I have to say that.
Yeah.
That's another thing my wife wanted to say, just to inject a little bit of liberty into the situation.
No, it's
completely
true.
I had to mention AIDS. But yes, completely enabled by hatred and bigotry.
Yeah.
Nobody would look after these men.
Yeah.
And it was primarily young men. Entire communities wiped out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's biology times stupidity equals outbreak.
Plus
it's
bigotry. yes.
And it was only the work of a few individuals who would basically look after these
cutting funding for something to fund new airplanes in the American Air Force, it's usually AIDS research that gets cut first. Mm. Well, hey-ho, that's a story for another day. Spanish flu, 20 million people at the end of the war. Mm. I didn't realise they're the top four. The next, if you like, biggest killer, the next biggest killing plague was the modern plague, 1894 to 1903. There was an outbreak of plague as recently as that, 100 years ago. Across various places, it even hit bits of America and in Asia and Europe, bits and pieces everywhere. Killed 10 million people across the world. The big outbreak was in the 1890s and sort of trickled on into the start of the century. But in Idaho, in June of this year, we had the first case of bubonic plague in the United States for 30 years. So it's not, we sort of think of bubonic plague as an old medieval disease, and it's still around.
Well, it's such an old word. It feels like a biblical word, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, just because you mentioned smallpox before, I forgot one thing, and I really wanted to mention this.
Yeah.
And I think this is just one more reason why I think smallpox is the worst plague of all time. It was carried on the ships to the New World.
Yeah.
And this is an entire continent with no resistance, no built-up resistance to it. Many of the accounts say that the conquistadors from the various expeditions would go inland and they would come to towns where, you know, Inca settlements where there were nobody was left alive.
Yeah, yeah.
Completely. Villages of the dead. And
some estimates I've read of the Aztec population was maybe as many as 90% of the people were killed by infectious diseases.
When introduced to an environment in which there was no resistance, it was potentially the greatest killer in terms of efficiency, in terms of mortality that we've ever seen.
Yeah,
I'm fascinated by how much the conquistadors knew what they were doing, because obviously 200 years later you get the people giving infected blankets to the Native Americans, very much knowing what they're doing, but the taking out of the Aztec of the Incas is such, again, it's an alignment of various factors. Obviously the fact that the conquistadors are armed with rifled weapons helps. Yes. That as far as I understand it, the way that Aztec calendar works, they see time not as a line, but it's spiral formed. So they believe that when the conquistadors appeared on the shores was the time that the gods were meant to return.
Yeah, it was a time of renewal, and I think was it Cortez?
Yes.
Cortez was seen as the rebirth of Quetzalcoatl.
Yes.
I can't say it. I hope I said that right.
Yeah, no, you're right.
But they were like, hey, come on. Yeah. Hey.
You look completely different to us. You must be a god.
Yeah. You know, you're supposed to be a feathered serpent, but hey. Right. So I have to say, though, it wasn't just smallpox. I mean, we know that tuberculosis... And what was the other one? I think bubonic plague as well.
Yeah,
they all came on those ships. So look, they were the most effective weapon that the Spaniards had.
Freeloaders.
Yeah.
Another end of the sort of during the end of the and during and into the end of the First World War, sleeping sickness, encephalitis lethargica, which that sort of big outburst for about 10 years. It killed a million lives. Obviously, it sort of paled into insignificance beside the flu, but still a million people around the world. First you get sore throat and then seizures and you'd fall into this sudden deep sleep, actually completely conscious, but it'd be like you were completely asleep and paralysed and eventually would die. And if you did wake up from it, a lot of people, they'd sort of lash out, extraordinarily violent, sexual violence and assault, clawing at their own eyes and things. So it seems to be some sort of virus that would attack the brain and was affecting people that way.
This is the one... that Awakenings is based on.
Oh, it might be, yeah.
I think it might be. I can't remember the name of the doctor. It wasn't Sack, it was someone else. But they worked out a treatment which could bring you out of that sort of catatonic state, but only for a little bit.
Yeah.
And the sleeping sickness would sort of disappear by itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody, they haven't quite fully worked
They've
out
They've no what idea what caused it. They're still, even now, an entire show, and there's modern outbreaks of different sleeping sicknesses which aren't the same as this one. And this disappeared really suddenly. Just for about 10 years, killed a million people around the world, and then just evaporated.
That's
so it must have
really scary.
Yeah, it's and they think it's almost certain it's something that was sort of eating at your brain and affecting it in some way, but they can't quite pin down what it was. Let's talk about some slightly sillier things.
Please.
And then 1983, you had the outbreak of West Bank fainting in the West Bank. In Araba and Palestine, a schoolgirl, oh, a lot of these start with school children, started coughing and then collapsed in a faint. And then others at the school followed suit. Within weeks, 900 people across the West Bank were just having these coughing fits and then fainting for no apparent reason.
Was it just kids going, I think I found a way to get off school?
More on this later, Ben.
Okay.
Yeah. The former mayor of one of the towns affected, Wahid Hamdallah, naturally accused the Israelis of poisoning. And 250 people in the city of Jenin got it after a car drove through the town with smoke pouring out of its exhaust. They're just convinced it was some sort of... Just psychosomatically decided that this must be some of the poison in the air. They traced the original outbreak to maybe some fumes from a latrine overpowering the girl. But yeah, 80% of the cases were psychosomatic. In all, there were 943 hospitalizations of this. And yeah, 80% of them. So what was that? About 800 of them were just people getting it into their heads that something was going on with them. I found a couple of Frenchmen. Have you heard of the Jumping Frenchmen of Maine?
Go on.
So this first described in 1878, particularly among French Canadian lumberjacks in Maine. For some reason, if you were one of these French Canadian lumberjacks suffering from whatever this disorder was, if I just suddenly went, "Punch Mike," you would do it. I said, "Jump off the chair." You would just do it for whatever reason. It was some sort of suggestibility or startle reflex was being affected by this disorder, possibly genetic, because it was among the particularly reasons called Jumping Frenchmen of Maine, is if you told them to jump, they'd just do it. And it seemed to be among this community of lumberjacks. So at the slightest provocation, whatever command you would shout at them, they would just do it.
So it was jumping, but they would just do anyway?
So they were naturally very jumpy. So the, oh, right, so the slight, right, right. So obviously their startle reflex was being inflamed by something, but then that seemed to then transfer into this robotic response where you would tell them to do something and they would react accordingly.
Yeah, because I'm just wondering how, and like, who was the first one to discover that you could get them to do whatever you want?
I know, that's something you could definitely take advantage of.
Yeah.
But yeah, they just jump and scream at any such thing. Some of them displayed echolalia, so that thing of you'd hear me speaking, you just sort of repeat, do my accent back at me, or repeat my words back at me, or imitate the sounds of things that you hear. So yeah, so definitely some sort of imitative and startle reflex was being affected. Even weirder was a case of dromomania, or pathological tourism, among a French...
Come on now.
Yeah, particularly strong in France between 1886 and 1909. Weirdly, it sort of stopped when people began actually investigating the disease medically and scientifically and psychologically. The first guy...
I think I've heard about this one, yeah.
Yeah, the first guy to exhibit this case is a guy called Jean-Albert Dada, a gas fitter from Bordeaux. And he was admitted to Saint-André Hospital in 1886 with no recollection of where he'd been, what he'd done, exhausted, sort of battered and scarred and worn down, and just clearly he'd been travelling and being long distance, but no memory of what he'd done. And they managed to piece together from journals and sort of interviewing people that he had left the French army in 1881 and ended up in Prague, and then walked to Berlin, and then gone to Prussia, and then to Moscow, where he was arrested on suspicion of assassinating the Tsar. The Tsar had just been assassinated. And France and Russia were not on great terms at the time.
Like, how did he get out of that one?
He was marched in exile to Turkey by the Russians.
Right, okay.
Where the
it's
French...
Remarkably.
Well,
he probably went, that's convenient. I quite wanted to see you stand all this time of year.
Well, then the French consulate came across him in Constantinople, and they sent him to Vienna. And then he ended up walking back to France. So he'd just been on this weird journey where something had gone wrong where he'd left the army, and either something had misfired or rewired, and he'd lost the routine of being in the army, or he'd left the army in disgrace, not entirely sure what, and he just wandered the continent for 5 years.
Sounds like a fugue state.
Yeah, it does seem like maybe something like that. But his story got out, and then others just imitatively started doing it as well and wandering across Scotland, not really knowing where they were going. This sort of mass outbreak of tourism. Well, maybe just people just wanted to go see the world a bit. Was it interrailing.
Was it tourism though? Was it just a pathological desire?
It's pathological tourism is the sort of descriptor of a drama.
Because I mean,
that's
something I'd love to sort of go to present to my doctor with.
I can't stop going to the Balearics. I gotta
go to Prague, buddy.
Yeah. How long is this going to last, this appointment? Yeah. As soon as they started, psychoanalysis and psychotherapy started to come into fashion, as soon as they started examining it. It disappeared.
Mm. It just sounds like brains sometimes misfire in the weirdest possible ways.
Really
and
odd,
sometimes it's a disease and sometimes it's art.
Yes. But I'm going to talk about, and you sort of vaguely touched on this, Morangos com Açúcar virus. Now, Morangos com Açúcar, it means strawberries with sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Strawberries with Sugar was a popular Portuguese soap opera which premiered in the year 2003 and ran for about 10 years, ended in 2012. And it's a tale of normal teenage kids and their ups and downs in their daily lives, you know, sort of show that everyone would watch. If you like a Disney Channel type show that you'd watch day in, day out. May 2006, early in whatever series that was, fourth or fifth series, a life-threatening disease struck the school depicted on the TV programme.
Oh, no.
And days later, children around Portugal started experiencing the same symptoms as the kids on the TV show. Rashes, breathing issues, dizziness. It spread to 300 children in 14 different schools. Some of the schools actually had to close down. Obviously, it's May. It's around exam time. Suspicions were raised that it was kids trying to get out. But
surely.
No, the symptoms were sort of, if you like, presented strongly enough. And it couldn't have been that well coordinated and that widespread in the view of doctors to actually be a deliberate outbreak. In fact, it affected largely children with allergies. There was some imitation, but not a lot. But Dr. Mario Almeida said, I know of no disease which is so selective that it only attacks school children. So he figured out that it had to be, or they figured out that it had to be, they were being affected by this TV show. It wasn't just an actual disease or something, like a minor outbreak or something. That was all the kids who'd watched this programme and were just being psychosomatically affected by what they'd seen on television.
That's incredible.
The power of TV.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's so weird that that sort of stuff must have happened elsewhere. You know, like people watching EastEnders and suddenly calling everyone a slag.
Yes. So I'm gonna suggest Morangos com Açúcar virus, the TV-born kids virus. So our candidates this week for the world's worst epidemic are Ben's suggestion of CORO, or genital retraction syndrome. It's very cold, in here. Mike's suggestion of smallpox from the Antonine Plague to the modern times, one of the most laid-back yet effective killers around, and my suggestion of the Morangos com Açúcar virus based on a kid's soap opera in Portugal. Great work all around. A nice sort of mix of actual horrible diseases and weird culture-bound ones, and then a stupid TV one. And let's be honest, we're going to go with the stupid TV one.
Oh, are we?
I think of all the diseases, obviously smallpox, horrendous.
We've
killed
got rid
lots
of it.
People.
It's gone.
It's not around anymore.
Yeah.
CORO, it's very culture-bound. There's obviously there's some weird like history behind it, and there's been lots and lots of outbreaks of it, but I love the idea of 300 kids just getting seeing someone on EastEnders having a cough and then everyone having a cough at work the next day.
It would have to be the most piss week.
Yeah.
It is the most piss week one. It's like loads of Geordie kids in the mid 90s going, I can't come to school today, I'm blind.
Good.
PJ and Duncan.
PJ and Duncan. Which one of them went blind?
Duncan, maybe.
One of them. Ant or Deck.
And the one played by Ant.
The one on the left.
Yeah. Yes.
So, shout out to the school children of Portugal and their doctors who had to put up with sick notes told to watch American Idol for the week. Before we go, I've got to give you the world's worst news of the week. That comes from The Mirror, where I often go for my bizarre news. And this is the news that an underwear addict who spends £2,600 on lacy outfits every year has revealed how she's gotten into trouble at work for her underwear passion. This is a girl called Ellie Hatful. I don't know why that name tickles me so much.
Straight out of a restoration comedy, that one.
Yeah, she spends $2,500 a year on sort of lacy underwear and bra. Now, I have to say, she does have her own Instagram page where she sort of posts about, I think it's called Lace and Haze is the name of the Instagram.
So what's the name of that again?
Lace and Haze.
Great.
She shares her passion for her underwear. I mean, Instagram is definitely the place to share your passion for underwear.
So is she wearing them or is she just
yes.
them?
No, there she is actually wearing them. It's not just collecting them.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So she's a very attractive young lady. But she does say that now, recently she's gotten into trouble because management comes by her at work and says how her outfit is not work appropriate, that you're not meant to be able to see the bra or throw underneath them. She lives in a constant state of visible panty line, it seems. And her constant response is, okay, I'll remember tomorrow. My favourite thing about it is on her blog she says, I can see your bra, not the company's atheistic. I think she's meant aesthetic. Mike, where can people find you and follow your Twitter and all of that sort of stuff?
Okay, if you're looking for, if you'd like to look me up on Twitter, it's Mike Stuchbery, MikeStuchbery _. And I tell stories about history and particularly the sort of heavy metal bits.
He's one of our favourite people to follow. So do if you follow us, then take your next step in the rings of Kevin Bacon and find Mike. Meanwhile, we're all off to go and treat Ben's case of Emmerdale Ebola. Thank you for listening to Worst of Ford. Goodbye.
Was Mike Stuchbery, and thank you so much to Mike again for coming on our podcast and sharing his outstanding historical knowledge about an array of things, both uplifting and really quite sinister indeed. As you can probably hear, I'm speaking quite quietly because I am sat in my living room under a blanket for purposes of sound deadening whilst my wife and tiny child are asleep next door. So this is going to be a super quick end of show message. First of all, to say the delightful thing with having Mike on was I follow Mike on Twitter and thought he would be an amazing guest for the podcast, got in touch, and he was well up for it, which is one of my favourite things about doing this podcast. If you're listening to this and you follow someone on Twitter who you think would be a brilliant guest and would be well up for coming on this show, please do drop us a line and let us know, because we always want to get new interesting people that we maybe have missed onto the show. You can contact us on @worstfoot on Twitter, worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. I'm on @BenVanderveld and Barry's on @BazMcStay. If you would like to suggest a topic for a show, if you're listening to this and thinking, I don't just want to suggest a guest, I think there is a topic that I would very much like Ben and Barry to research and do a show about, you absolutely can. If you want to do that, we are going to ask a little bit more of you. Become a subscriber on Patreon. If you donate just $5 a month, which, let's face it, is the price of a terrible pint or an excellent coffee, then you will be able to suggest a show topic. Topics that have been suggested by Patreon subscribers of late have been World's Worst God, World's Worst Scientific Fraud, and World's Worst Train. I know that we've got two guests lined up for them. We're still searching for a good guest for World's Worst God. So if you've thought of a good one, if you think you know a good one for that, do drop us a line and let us know. We're 4 Patreon supporters away from hitting our next target. And when we hit that, we will provide an extra in-depth episode a month, accessible and available to all. If you like the sound of what we're doing, you want to become a supporter, head to patreon.com/worstfootforward and you can donate from as little as $2 a month. Cheeky little shout-out goes to Andrew McNamara, who did just that last week. Welcome on board, Andrew. It is a delight to be supported by you. Finally, I must tell you about next week's guest. We have a brilliant South African comedian on, a chap whose name I think I mangled throughout the podcast, and I will mangle now, Schalk Bezuidenhout. And Schalk joined us to talk about the world's worst gig. Now, as you can imagine, me and Barry did all sorts of research into horrible music gigs and cabaret and jesters and stand-ups, and I shared my war stories and war stories of some of my friends, but I tell you now, Shalk's own lived World's Worst Gig is something to behold. If you listened to John Robertson's episode on the World's Worst Housemate and enjoyed his real-life story, horror story, then you're going to love the sacrifice that Shalk made for you, the listener, in performing at what I think was probably the most horrifying stand-up comedy gig of all time. That and much more coming next week. I'm now going to try and creep into my bedroom without waking anyone and becoming the world's worst father and husband. Until then, bye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.